Secondly, I'd like to contribute towards the understanding to stop Holocaust II, which is my journalistic shorthand for another great turning against the Jews. Because if Israel goes on behaving like it is, anti-Israelism will grow and grow and be transformed into anti-Semitism. Mm. And I can tell you I have many Jewish friends in America, really high-placed Jewish friends, who don't dispute when I say, as things are, if anti-Semitism really starts again, it could start in America, not Europe.
And I'd like to... Sorry. Yes, sir. Sorry, I cut you off there. I apologise. You were saying?
You see, I've been going to America throughout my career a lot.
Yes.
And I've spoken behind closed doors to many congressmen, senators, and representatives of the lower house, privately. And over the years, they've all said to me the same thing. Alan, yes, we hate ourselves for being Zionist lobby fodder, but that's the way the system is. That's the way we have to play it. But you see, the point, gentlemen, is this. If ever the day comes when they can break free of their control by the Zionist lobby through funding, principally for campaign finance, if ever they can break free, they will want their revenge. You see what I'm saying?
Yes, yes.
So there is a very, very dangerous situation being created. But my fear for the Palestinians, I can put into two or three sentences. When the Israelis finally get the message that they can't break the Palestinian will to continue their struggle, they can't break the will by violence and brutal suppression, and they can't get the Palestinians to accept a few crumbs from Zionism's table, I think they will create the circumstances to drive the Palestinians off the West Bank and into Jordan and Syria, wherever. I think, as things are, we are on course for the final ethnic cleansing of Palestine. I think that's how bad the situation is.
Well, and we've actually run short of time now, actually, because we have also Martin Summers waiting on the line. We really thank you for giving us your time, and once again, I'd like to request that I hope you could join us again for a future show.
Yes, it would be my pleasure.
Well, Alan, thank you very much for a very enlightening discussion, and for coming and giving us your time. That was Alan Hart. Thank you very much.
All right, my friend.
Thanks. Alan, thank you for coming on Unity FM. You are listening to Behind the Headlines on 93.5 Unity FM. Of course, on the last 45 minutes of the show, I've been absolutely fascinating, even for me. And I've been doing this show nearly 3 years, Tarek. You and I have been doing this show.
Almost.
And it's been a fascinating listen, actually, to Alan Hart and enlightening us all.
Well, somebody else was listening with us as well, and that, of course, was Martin, who's been waiting all this
absolutely.
Time. And Martin, are you still with us?
I am, yes.
Thanks for waiting. What did you think of that?
Well, I do know Alan, and I know his work, and he's a very, very thorough journalist of the old school. And I think he's over-exaggerating. I understand his fear that anti-Israelism may become anti-Semitism, but I think, actually, most sensible people can distinguish between the two things. There are many Jews active in Bristol, for example, to oppose Israeli aggression, and they, you know, I think that everybody understands that it's not really about that. It's about bad behaviour, whoever does it. And I think that there is, you know, the modern world has got sufficient understanding to make the distinction, I hope.
But do you really think, do you not think, though, Martin, if I may say that, because... As Alan said, the cancerous cell is the conflict between Israel and Palestine, which is causing the whole instability in the Middle East. Do you not think that would, I mean, bring Alan's fears to pass?
I think some horrible things can happen.
Mm.
Absolutely. I mean, just think of a potential for a nuclear war, which is absolutely there. You know, the Israelis have got 200 nuclear weapons. They're mad enough to use them under certain circumstances. And that could kill an awful lot of people.
Mm.
But it's not the same thing as going back to a 1940-style Holocaust against Jewish people, is it? It's a different horror. The problem with history is it keeps bringing up new, more horrifying things than the past. And it's not the past that's repeated. It's more horrible things in a different format.
Mm. Yeah, well, I'd have to agree with that, yes. Yeah. It just seems to get, in some ways, unfortunately, worse and worse, really. But perhaps
I'm
that's because...
So.
It's because of what we're not doing, really. It's, you know, the Egyptians, as Alan said, have, in a way, set a precedence for their determination, that they were determined that they wanted democracy. They were determined that they wanted to change. They wanted, you know, to create a revolution, to change their circumstances. And they have to be admired for what they've done.
Indeed we do. And if we remember, well, last week on this show, we were talking about the bombing in Alexandria of the church on New Year's Eve.
Yes, we were.
That's terrible.
And how the interior minister, the former interior minister of Egypt, Minister Habib al-Adli, has been arrested as the perpetrator, or the ultimate perpetrator, of that bombing.
And rightly so.
Yes. But whether anything will come of that is another question. But I've just got some more detail about this here. The two people who were originally arrested for the bombing were Jundullah leader Mohammed Abdel Hadi and a Muslim Brotherhood supporter, Mohammed Khalid, who were apparently set up to meet after the explosion by the Interior Ministry to evaluate the success of the attack. During that meeting, they were arrested. And then they were blamed for it. Now, in other words, what you've got is the Mukhabarat in Egypt setting up terrorist groups. They go out and carry out a terrorist atrocity, in this case against Christians. Then they are arrested and accused of being Muslim terrorists, even though they were themselves working for the security services in the first place. And it reminds me very much of the 1993 attack on the World Trade Center, which was rightly blamed on a Muslim extremist group. But that Muslim extremist group had been created by the FBI. Mm. The explosives they used for the attack were given to them by the FBI. Six people died, and they were and then all these people were rounded up. They'd all got visas to get into the United States from the State Department. So in other words, it was a completely state-created plot. And then, of course, the people who actually carried it out were then all arrested and accused of being Muslim extremists, which indeed they were. Now, what I'm trying to drive at here is there are groups out there, Muslim extremist groups doing bad things, but they are often and quite frequently linked to security services. And
well, you mentioned, you mentioned Jundullah. Now, there's been this YouTube video floating around for a while of apparently a member of this Jundullah, an Iranian group, actually.
Well, there's a number of different. This is a Jundullah in Egypt, so I don't know what this.
This is a different one.
I'm just reading what I've got on the article I read earlier today.
Okay.
I mean, as you well know, there's a whole forest of different groups out there with different grievances.
That's right.
But the fishing expert. What happens is, basically there's a pattern here with intelligence services supporting certain groups, even groups which they claim to be fighting against, in order to try and create an atmosphere of fear. So you can see clearly what was going on in Egypt. The bombing of the Christian church was to create sectarian hatred between the two groups.
Mm.
And that was planned. It seems to have come a cropper. I mean, I hope this guy gets punished. I hope it all comes out.
Absolutely.
We've seen all this stuff this week about Mohammed Junaid Barbar in the United States being released after a 4-year term. And
yes.
We were talking about that just when we had the interruption.
That's right, yeah.
What people have got to realise is that I'm not saying this is the case, but you could imagine a situation where you have got a group in Britain that goes to bomb the London Underground in good faith, believing themselves to be soldiers of Allah or whatever deluded in their mind.
Once again, Martin, we're just actually a few seconds away from a break again. If you could stay with us, for 5 minutes after the break, we'll continue this conversation. Again, we apologise to Martin and to everybody for the technical problems we've been having throughout the show. If you want to call us, it's 0121 772 8892. You've got the Facebook page that's behind the headlines as well. And do keep a lookout, of course, because hopefully the shows that you've heard will be uploaded via Mixcloud.com, and you'll be able to listen to the show via our Facebook page in the next few days as well.
Should also be on SoundCloud as well, and hopefully on radioforall.net. 93.5 Unity FM. We are back after the break with more, I'll say...
More of the same.
More of the same, of course, more of the same. And we've got your sports review coming up. It's just after 9 o'clock, today the 15th of February 2011. You're listening to 93.5 Unity FM. This is Behind the Headlines with me, Saeed Ahmed, Tariq Ziad and Humayun. Good evening, all.
Good evening.
And of course, Martin Summers is on the line with us as well. So we were just been talking to Martin Summers just before we went to the ad break for 9 o'clock. Over the last hour, it's been a fascinating show, if I may say so myself. Alan Hart, fascinating conversation we had with him. For many of you who've just tuned in, you've missed it, but fear not.
Hopefully, we are saying hopefully. Yep. That's within the next couple of days, it should be on our Facebook page. You should be able to listen to it via mixcloud.com. There should be links up there to listen to the show and links to possibly download the show as well.
Absolutely,
from,
absolutely.
Radioforall.net and from soundcloud.com as well. So keep checking the page. And if you,
as I say, watch the space.
And use the page right now. It's up right now. If you want to post your comments. We'll read them out. You know, let's have a discussion. Give us a call, 0121-772-8892. Send us a text as well.
07926-843-388. You know, you can come on air, have a debate with us, whether you agree, disagree, or if you think we're talking complete tush, come on, do tell us so. 0121-772-8892. Sports coming up very, very shortly with Mr. Humayun, but before that, let's go back to Mr. Summers.
Hello there, am I back?
Yes, you are. Sir, yes. Well, yeah, welcome back, Martin.
We were talking, I mean, obviously Alan was talking about Zionism, and I was really focusing on what you might call false flag terrorism, the use of terrorism by the state.
That's right,
to,
yes.
To basically sow discord amongst people. And a classic example of that by the Zionist state was the Lavon affair in the 1950s, where bomb attacks were carried out on Western targets in Egypt.
Yes.
And then, of course, the guys who were actually carrying out the bomb attacks were captured, and they turned out to be Israelis. Pretending to be Islamic extremists.
Yes.
So this pattern is a very old pattern, and it's a pattern that's not quite frequently repeated. Can I just draw your attention of your listeners to a few other things that I've picked up this week around this topic? So, for example, we had David Cameron this week complaining that the Labour government had allowed al-Megrahi, the alleged Lockerbie bomber, to go back to Libya. The presumption being, of course, that Megrahi is guilty. Whereas, of course, why the British government let him go is because his appeal was just about to come up, and a Scottish police inspector was about to testify that the CIA had interfered with the crime scene, to wit, had planted the circuit board which linked Libya to the bombing. And that's why the British government had to release him, because if it had gone to appeal, he would have got off, and then the Scottish police would have had to started a whole investigation of the CIA interference with the crime scene. David Cameron seems to have lost the plot there, because if he keeps banging on about this is all going to come out, and that's why the Labour government were trying to keep quiet about it. So that's again another massive terrorist event in which hundreds of people were killed, and the story we've been told turns out to be a load of rubbish, and it goes on. I mean, what may have happened this week, which some of your listeners may or may not have picked up, is that there's been a warrant issued in Pakistan for the arrest of General Musharraf in relation to the assassination of Benazir Bhutto.
Ah, yes, I did hear about this, yes. Yeah.
Yeah, did you see? I mean, do you remember we all saw the video, which looked like some guy was actually shooting her before the bomb went off? On the basis of that, the authorities in Pakistan have now issued a warrant for Musharraf's arrest. I understand he's in London. So that's where... That's an ongoing...
Do you think, Martin, do you think that... the British government will actually extradite Musharraf to Pakistan?
Well, I don't know. It's very hard to speculate, isn't it? I mean, but what we're seeing here is just we look under the curtain and there's an awful lot more going on than we really understand.
Certainly, I mean, one thing we know about Musharraf and the current leader, Mr. Bhutto himself, the current leader of Pakistan, is that they're both very wealthy men. They own quite a lot of...
Well, indeed. And, of course, wealthy criminals oft sometimes fall out. And when they do fall out, sometimes they give each other away. And that's why we sometimes hear about these things, which otherwise we wouldn't possibly hear about. I mean, another incident in Pakistan this week is there's a big standoff going on between the US embassy and the Pakistani authorities about one Raymond Davis, who looks like he works for Blackwater or some similar mercenary outfit,
yes,
who has shot two guys dead, and he's now been arrested for murder. Now, I don't know what's going on there. Some suggestions are that he was carrying out some spying and that these two guys he shot were actually Pakistani agents or whatever. But in any case, there's now a standoff going on between the Pakistani authorities who want to prosecute him and the American authorities who want him to be let go with diplomatic immunity. But of course, you know, what you've actually got probably in Pakistan is low-level magistrates are doing their job of indicting Musharraf and refusing to release this chap, Raymond Davis.
Yes.
But of course, they're not necessarily in final control of what will happen. It's some deal done behind the scenes between people further up the chain than them. But this is a big question, isn't it? Do we have an independent police force that looks into things without fear or favour? Or is it all fixed at the end of the day, like this chap, Mohammed Junaid Babar, being let off because he's actually, in fact, been our agent all along, or we recruited him long before he was arrested?
Yeah, well, some of the MPs were referring to him as a super gross.
Well, exactly. I mean, but it raises not, it's not just a question of they could have stopped the bombers. I mean, obviously, a lot of the relatives are saying that they must have known something, they could have stopped them. It's more serious than that. Maybe they wanted them to succeed. And that in actual fact, what we're looking at is the that's what we're really looking at is all of these intelligence agencies. And just think how many might be involved. You know, you've got the Pakistani intelligence services, the ISI, the CIA, Mossad. It's not just talking about the British intelligence services here. All of these different groups all use this false flag technique. And the population has to try and wake up and realise that basically we don't really know what's going on. And there's another fellow, David Headley,
who was
the spotter for the Mumbai attack. So he was the one who went and cased all the different buildings and all the rest of it. And it turns out that he was working for the Americans, and he's now in custody in the US. The Indians want to extradite him back to India, but the Americans don't want to extradite him. Probably
the plot thickens, eh?
Well, I mean, there's been an article today, actually, Martin, on blacklistednews.com that some of the London bombers at the time were working for the US administration.
Well, there we go. I mean, I'm not. What I would say is we don't know what's going on.
No, we don't.
What we do know is that the sort of stuff we're being told is clearly not what's going on. Yeah, we're being given. There's a certain narrative. Being the purpose of all of these attacks is to get the ordinary population, the kind of people that perhaps don't listen to Unity FM or listen to our show in Bristol, the kind of people that just switch on the news for half an hour a day, to get a very, very impressionistic view. There's lots of mad Muslims out there trying to attack us, so don't worry about the economy collapsing and all the rest of it. What you've got to do is be really, really scared of all of these people out there who are trying to attack us. And by the way, can you pay more for our military because we need to invade somewhere?
Well, Martin, I apologise.
We've got to knock this on the head.
Yes, we do.
If we're going to have a war on terror, then we're going to have to talk about terrorism. And that means discussing things like timelines, jarking of bombs, which means fiddling with bombs when in order to make them go off or not go off. All the sorts of things that people in Belfast have been talking about for 30 years, and they can give you a long conversation. Just so you can have a conversation about cricket in a pub in Sussex, you can go to a pub in Belfast, and you can have a conversation about this kind of thing. Now, if we're going to have this war on terror, and it seems that we are, then I'm afraid we're going to have a much more serious discussion about all of these things than we've had thus far. And I very much welcome the opportunity to come on your show and to just hint at the kind of things that are out there. And of course, people shouldn't take my word for it. They should go and check for themselves. Go and look.
Martin, as ever, we really...
Before Martin goes, I wonder if I could just say something.
Of course, this is Tony Gosling, by the way, guys.
Hi there, yeah. This is really referring back to what Martin was talking about, this attack on the Coptic Christian Church on New Year's Day, with the Egyptian Interior Minister, Habib El Adli, who is now being investigated for actually planning that attack and sending some of his... what we're being told is that there was a special secret group of 22 police officers, which that was their remit, and they were the most secret organisation in Egypt up until the end of Mubarak and the end of the former administration. So, you know, people are looking at the situation in Egypt and wondering, well, is this now turned from a dictatorship into now a military coup and just simply the military running the country? Because one of the things that's come out where some of the police have now decided that they're now no longer afraid of the Interior Minister and being killed themselves, that they are now talking about what was happening back before Mubarak went. And what we're being told, and this is on a blog called the Reason.com blog, which has pulled together quite a lot of articles, and it's got links to the articles in the mainstream Egyptian press. What they're saying is that the security forces guarding the church actually withdrew an hour before the bomb went off on New Year's Day. They're also saying that this special security system that was managed by these 22 secret officers actually employed a number of former radical Islamists, as Martin was saying. But also, one of the things that piqued my interest here was there were also drug dealers and private security firms were also employed by the Egyptian state to carry out these acts of sabotage around the country. And this seems to be actually dovetailing in with what Martin's saying there, really, about creating this state of siege, a state of tension. Of course, what this does is it drives the population back into the arms of the government, basically to protect them. It's like a kind of a mafia protection racket. That's what Egypt should be, come. And it does bother me that, you know, that this could be going on in all sorts of other places. We've also heard, of course, earlier this week about a British terrorist, someone who's actually just been released after only 5 years, who was supposedly the guy who trained the 7/7 London bombers. Now, I don't know if
we have covered this, Tony,
but did you mention that at all?
We did. This is Mohammed Junaid Baba.
That's right, yeah. And I mean, it does seem that there may be some sort of similar operation going on in the Western world. I mean, it's all very easy for us to look across at Egypt and point the finger at Egypt and say, isn't it terrible? Mubarak is so corrupt. But I wonder whether some of the techniques that have been employed clearly by the Egyptian Interior Ministry and Mubarak's corrupt regime, and he's now obviously biting his nails, wondering if his 20 billion or so, or possibly even more than that, pounds or dollars is going to be accessible to him in the future, whether similar sorts of arrangements are going on secretly behind the scenes under the cover of, you know, national security. This seems to be a sort of cover-all where many of the people who are involved in the MI5, MI6 special branch in the secret state here in Britain are basically not subject to hardly any scrutiny at all. There's something called the Intelligence and Security Committee in Parliament, which is supposed to look at these organisations, but very often budgets are just simply nodded through, what they call black budgets, where large amounts of money from the taxpayers are paid to these organisations, and they don't actually explain what that money is spent on at all. And this is all covered up under the guise of national security.
Tony and Martin, Tony, we will return to this subject very, very shortly. Again, I'd like to thank Martin Summers for joining us. Until next week, then Martin.
Yeah, well, thanks very much. I think my final comment is, of course, that it's Mukhabarat in Egypt, its closest allies were Mossad and the CIA. I rest my case. I'll speak to you next week.
Okay, Martin, well, thank you very much for coming on, and thanks to Martin Summers.
Are you still with us, Tony?
Yes, I'm here. Hi.
I don't know if you've been listening to, obviously, this little conversation here about this another big football stadium being built.
Yeah. Olympic Stadium.
The Olympic Stadium, and if you have any thoughts on that.
Well, not particularly. I mean, obviously, there's got to be there's got to be a little bit of something new has got to be put together for the Olympics next year.
Mm.
And it's, you know, listening to the people in charge of it, it seems like it is actually going to come in on budget. I'm just surprised, though, that the clubs are complaining that actually the stadium isn't the right shape to use for football.
Yeah.
I mean, I would have thought, like the old Crystal Palace Stadium in South London, you know, a stadium can be used both for football and for athletics. It's not
Solar
just
Park.
An athletics track. And that actually having an athletics track around the side of a stadium is a bonus. It just seems to me these people are rather... you know, there's a bit of sour grapes here, and they're not really taking it. And most clubs, if they had the chance of a massive Olympic stadium that's probably going to hold, you know, anything up to 100,000 people, would jump at the chance. And I just think that, as we were saying a couple of weeks ago, that the football has gone crazy on money. And actually, what we really want is clubs that run on sort of, you know, something like £100,000 a year, or, you know, or maybe a maximum million on gate, of what they're taking on the gate, and they're not paying their players these massive salaries. I mean, we've got a situation here in Bristol with Bristol City, where a multi-millionaire, Stephen Lansdowne, is running things here, and it's a lot of the fans in Bristol are actually, you know, they. It's almost like their heart misses a beat when one of these millionaires moves in on a big club, because then that's when a lot of the real big risks then get taken. Massive amounts of money get spent on this and that. And then you could end up like Pompey have in a situation where it's actually completely bankrupt. You know, a perfectly successful, a perfectly good club can go bankrupt in this sort of... It's a bit like the country, in a way. I mean, a microcosm of the country.
It is indeed. We are actually... we're about a few seconds away
from
the break again.
Well, we are, but just to give a bit of good news, actually, just before we go to the break, Birmingham losing 2-0 against Newcastle at the moment, I think, stands.
I can't decide that's good news.
Well,
his patriotism has left him here. But we will be back with Tony, finishing off the sports review and talking about many other things on the other side of the break.
Absolutely.
You can call us on 0121 772 8892. And we'll be back after this.
Unity FM 93.5. Subhanallah, walhamdulillah. Good evening and welcome to Behind the Headlines on 93.5 Unity FM. It's just after 9:30 today, the 15th of February 2011, 93.5 Unity FM, Birmingham. And before the break, you have been listening to our correspondent Humayun. I gotta say, actually, Birmingham fans, I mean, you guys are losing 2-0 at the moment, but you know, it happens. I mean, look at us, Vela at the moment. I mean, we haven't got much to gloat about, but you know, it happens. It happens.
Villa, so.
Hey, I don't want to be you know, cutting the mic off for the rest of the show. So if you can keep those good comments to yourself, I'd appreciate that. Who said this is not a dictatorship station, eh? Welcome back to Tony Gosling.
Hi, guys.
Hi, Tony. So we discussed a lot of things so far, and I wonder, Tony, if you had any topics you had in mind yourself.
Yeah, well, I've got several, but I mean, I think it's just lovely to hear Alan's voice again. You know, he's somebody I can remember seeing on the screen back in the 1970s, and you know, as a teenager, you know, this is it is a great shame that people like him, who have independent minds, are so often squeezed off the airwaves, particularly off, you know, off out away from our pages in our newspapers.
Well,
I mean, you know, this is really it's a tragedy that's happened in journalism over the last 20 or 30 years, and that is really what we call, as journalists, we call a crisis in investigative journalism, a crisis in critical thinking. What many of the younger journalists seem to do nowadays is to simply just report things without question, particularly things to do with the police. You know, I think it's one of the things that I experienced a lot during my time at the BBC, was the schmoozing by the police of journalists. Now, there's two sides to this. I mean, it's not just the police that do this. It's all sorts of big corporations. Back in the early 90s, there were several attempts by BT, you know, British Telecom, to they'd send invites to journalists saying, would you like to have a, you know, sort of free meal at the poshest restaurant in town? Would you like to... I mean, I even went on a weekend, not a whole weekend, but an afternoon on one Saturday of free go-kart racing when I was a journalist. I mean, that might sound a little bit childish, but it was great fun, courtesy of another organisation. And a lot of these big corporations know the best thing to do is to schmooze the journalists. And, of course, you know, you as an ordinary independent-minded journalist will think, you know, I can take this little treat and it won't necessarily change in any way the way I report on this organisation. But then, if you start doing this once or twice, after a while, you feel like you owe something to the organisations that's been schmoozing and treating you. And with the police, it used to be drinks in the police bar at Wiltshire Constabulary in Swindon, and we used to be you know, sort of bought drinks by the police. And the assumption was, oh, yes, we're all good chaps, we're all friends. Now that makes it absolutely impossible, really, I think, for journalists to then go on screen, on the radio, or in the newspaper, and really be totally independent about the people that they've just been sitting down, being schmoozed and having drinks with. And I think this is one of the problems, one of the reasons why investigative journalism is going through such a crisis these days.
Yes.
If you were to go back 20 or 30 years, you'll find almost every night of the week on the television, on the old, whatever it was, ITV, you know, Channel 3, or else on BBC One. I mean, BBC Two wasn't so much a documentary channel. That there would be something on almost every night of the week, which was some kind of investigation. Mm. That kind of is almost completely gone now. We've got Panorama, which is a much watered down from the Panorama of old, and we've got Dispatches, which is still pretty good. But there were all sorts of other programs, World in Action, This Week.
That's right, I remember those programs myself.
Yes, I do, actually, myself.
I mean, actually, yes, well, I mean, World in Action was produced not far from you up in Manchester.
Yes.
And it was absolutely hard, cutting-edge stuff. When there was an assassination in Gibraltar by the SAS of some IRA people, it was literally the investigative documentary went out on the television within a week. Since the September the 11th attacks, we still haven't had a decent investigative documentary into the September the 11th attacks nearly 10 years later. So you can see what I'm saying here is that actually the whole nature of our television screens has been changed. And a lot of this is, you know, it's a kind of dumbing down of TV, a little bit like the US. You know, we had our three channels and then Channel 4 came along. and the US for a long, long time had many channels, and now we've got literally hundreds of channels to watch. But actually, the real truth is not to be found on any of them. What is to be found is a sort of official spin. Because journalists, it's much easier for the journalists that are putting programs together to get an official spokesperson saying an official story. And they simply aren't asking the questions many of the times. I mean, for example, with all the terrorist legislation that's come in over the last 10 years, mostly since the 9/11 attacks, there's a real problem with all of that, in that the terrorist legislation is used and invoked on many occasions, and then actually there are no charges. Now, one of the things that every journalist should ask at a situation where terrorist charges are even talked about, let alone actually brought against somebody, is, well, couldn't you just charge this person with an ordinary offence? Why does it have to be a terrorist offence? But how many times have you ever heard a journalist ask that question? They don't, because there really isn't that critical thinking now in journalism when they're asking. And also, they know that their job now is simply to report what they see.
Well, I know I've mentioned this before, Tony.
The police got very, very proactive. The police are very, very... For example, if a journalist, as we saw in the Joanna Yates murder case in Bristol, starts being critical in any way of the way the police are operating, then they're simply locked out of the press conference. They don't get any news anymore.
Yeah. I know I've mentioned this in the past on previous shows. I'm just going to bring up again my own personal experience of going to a university. I'm not going to mention the name of that university, in the hope of doing a course, a journalism course. They were actually offering it free to one person, basically. And that would have involved going to the BBC and many other things as well. When I went to the interview for this course, one of the things they asked me was who was one of the journalists that influenced me the most. And I mentioned John Pilger. John Pilger has won awards for his journalism. He's won awards. But when I mentioned John Pilger to these people, they described him as being a polemist. That was their words. And that actually shocked me, because John Pilger has done some of the best documentaries in the last few decades that I've ever seen.
He's an award-winning filmmaker. He's actually primarily, I would say, a filmmaker. That's the way I think that he's had the biggest impact. He's been working, with people like World in Action, and he's an ITV guy. He's been working for something like 20, 30, 40 years nearly. And so he certainly is not just, as your guy who's interviewing was saying, a columnist. I can tell you as well, within the BBC, there's a kind of whispering campaign against John, and this is the way these things often work. If you talk to BBC producers, Panorama people, etc., they'll say, oh, yes, well, John Pilger, he got this wrong and he got that, and they're concentrating constantly on tiny, niggly points that he's got wrong. And this is the way these things work. It's almost tribal. There are people at the BBC who whisper about John Pilger, say, oh, you know, he's no good, he's not very good at this, he's not very good at that, and he's not the right kind of guy, he makes too many mistakes, he's too much of a conspiracy theorist, these kinds of things. And this creates almost a sort of groupthink, you know, from 1984 about, look, this guy is just not, you know, we're not going to commission programs from him. It was interesting because I interviewed a guy called Brian Barr, who was a documentary producer for the BBC in the 1980s, and he was explaining in quite great detail, and people can go on to our thisweek.org.uk website and have a listen to the interview if they want. He was explaining how the way the BBC has changed now means that the documentaries that he made in the 1980s, which were so hard-hitting, groundbreaking, I mean, he made the first ever documentary about the dangers of the database state, you know, the massive amounts of information being collected on the public, how they simply would not be made now, and they could not be made now at the BBC, because there's this whole culture of it being a kind of officialdom. Can be criticised in a small way, but there couldn't be any kind of organised conspiracy within officialdom. I wouldn't say necessarily the government, but certainly within the state apparatus, including the police and the security services. That kind of thing simply can't happen. And as we've seen in Egypt with the attack on the Coptic Christian church, it certainly can happen. And in fact, for criminal elements, particularly political criminal elements, it creates the perfect cover for them, operating within the state apparatus and the secret services.
Well, yes, I mean, journalism certainly is it's at a precipice right now. It really is, and where's it going to go is a very important question.
Yeah, it's worrying, because so much of what we see on our TV screens nowadays is kind of dumbed down, and this is why I've been doing this series on on censorship, because I think it's one of those things that it's an error by omission. It's very easy to sit and watch TV and think, oh, well, that was an entertaining evening's worth of television. But what about the things that you didn't see? And I can always remember a very good friend of mine is a Danish writer. He was telling me about what the most famous news anchorman in Denmark was incredibly popular. I don't think we've ever had anybody quite so popular here in Britain. The only equivalent I can think of was Ian McCaskill as the weatherman, you know,
who was
a really popular guy. And one
night, that Michael Fish chap.
Well, yeah, I mean, some of the weathermen really are popular, aren't they?
Yes,
Michael Fish certainly was after 1987.
There's a TV anchorman in Denmark, and one night at the end of the broadcast, He actually said, at the end of the live TV news broadcast, he stared into the screen, a wry smile, he said, "And that is what we decided to tell you tonight." And the next day he was sacked. So he just said that actually the way, the authoritative way that the news comes across, etc., is used to sort of almost mesmerise people, is that this is the news. Well, now, if you go on the internet, you'll see there are hundreds of different newses. But the people who put the news across on our TV screens particularly like to think that that bulletin that they are reading is actually the news. It's somehow definitively everything. But of course,
let's just go quickly to a call, Tony, and let's speak to
Javed.
Javed, is it?
Assalamu alaikum, brother.
Wa alaikum salam.
MashaAllah, great show as usual.
Thank you very much.
I think it's you know, it's a coincidence that today I was reading a you know, something about journalists in one of the Red Tops. Don't want to say their name because I don't buy the paper. For the last 10 years, I haven't bought any Red Top. But this newspaper basically was saying that that, you know, that if William Hague, the foreign minister, does not sort of back any government which doesn't back Israel, basically is doomed for failure.
I mean, William Hague said this today.
You know, this is a journalist in a national newspaper.
And may we ask what paper you got this from, Brother Javed?
Yeah, it was in The Sun, basically, right? I mean, I just went and sat in this office today. I went to get my car sort of MOT'd, and then I thought, it's free. That's the only time I read it.
So the title of this was, could you repeat, what was the name of this article again?
Yeah, there was a little piece, and basically it's all these people who write columns for The Sun.
Okay, columnists, yeah.
They have this lady as well. I don't know if her name is Carol or something like that.
Yes.
And then this other, today when I read this, this column in The Sun, I could not believe basically that you have to follow a certain line that has to please the neoconservative and the Jewish lobby, because if you do not follow that line, You probably end up losing your job. I have never ever seen in a newspaper in this country, which actually talks about the plight of the Palestinians. Never in the newspaper, and never in the mainstream media.
You do sometimes, to be fair, get the Independent or the Guardian. You know,
particularly the Independent these days, and the Guardian not quite so much, but certainly the Independent. Obviously they have a columnist in there called Robert Fisk.
Of course, a great journalist.
Yes.
He's actually quite, I would say, balanced. I mean, obviously the Israelis wouldn't, but I mean, he points the finger of blame very firmly at the side of the aggressors who are taking the land. And I think that at the end of the day, you know, when you're looking at any kind of situation, there's a lot of pressure on journalists to say, well, we've got to give both sides of the story. Mm. But hang on a minute. Let's look at who is actually doing the land grabbing. Who is it that's evicting people from their homes? Who is doing the bulldozing and pushing people out of the way here? They are obviously the aggressors in the situation. And they will come up with any kind of reason or excuse saying, oh, well, you know, they are bombing us, so we've got to bulldoze their homes. Actually, let's look at just not taking any of their land, and then maybe the whole situation will calm down. I think often, as was the case in Northern Ireland, land is a big, big part of it. I mean, if you go back into Northern Irish history, back into the 1800s, you'll find that land was at the heart of the Irish problem, particularly in Northern Ireland, right back, you know, even that far back, because Catholics were being evicted from the land in Ireland. And I think, you know, if we really want to understand and what Alan was saying about the Israel-Palestine conflict being at the heart of many of the world's problems, I think there has to be just simply a moratorium on the land. So that, yes, let the Israelis keep the Israel that they got as part of the UN settlement, but hand back the rest of the territory to the Palestinians, and then we can have peace.
Javed, thank you very much for your call.
Yes, thanks, Javi, for that. And continue with our conversation. We are discussing, of course, journalism at the moment, investigative journalism, the state of journalism in general. But moving on, were there any other topics you wanted to mention, Tony?
Well, there is one in the news today, which is about this poor woman, Linda Norgrove, who was killed in Afghanistan as people were the US Special Forces were attempting to rescue her. I don't know if you remember
that
case.
Yes, yes.
There's been actually a coroner's hearing today over this, and I mean, I look at this, and this is a perfect example of appalling journalism. The coroner's hearing actually took place at Swindon Coroner's Court, and even though it was supposed to be a coroner's inquest into her death, none of the people, it seems, who were actually involved in her death were actually there in the court. Instead, what they had was someone called British Brigadier Robert Nitsch, N-I-T-S-C-H, and he was just reading out what he had heard and from the US Special Forces soldiers that had killed this woman. So what we've got there is a kind of second-hand evidence. I have never in my life heard of somebody at a coroner's court who is a key witness actually not being there. What they've done is they've got somebody who's a friend or has you know, sort of heard what these other people have said, giving hard evidence. And amazingly enough, even though she was killed by a US Special Forces grenade, the final verdict by the coroner is that to praise the Americans for going in and trying to rescue her, which I just find absolutely incredible.
It is baffling.
Well, so I mean,
they haven't said anything about the, you know, what the wisdom or otherwise, and I think they've decided to just completely stay clear of criticising the US troops, and that's understandable. But you know, the idea that there was negotiations going on for her release, and that that the family would actually approve of a raid going in there and then actually killing her, I think is ridiculous. So,
it doesn't really matter that that a woman been killed, but let's praise the US troops for doing a fantastic job of actually going in there and killing a woman.
I know, it's very, very strange, and this is the sort of thing that's happening in many of our coroner's courts now, including the 7-7 inquest, is that, a lot of the basic standards of inquest seem to be out of the window. I mean, for some bizarre reason, here in Bristol and in Gloucestershire, both of the coroners in both of these two zones have been, both for different reasons, have been sacked. Now, it seems that there is actually quite an assault on the old inquest system, in that some of the verdicts that have been coming up, I mean, you can go back to the Diana inquest as well. You want to go into this, that actually it seems that our coroner's courts, which were once fiercely independent, some of the most respected lawyers in the country were then appointed to be totally independent coroners, are almost falling like ninepins, and that the this is a very, very important part of our justice system in Britain. But for the coroner in this case in Wiltshire with Linda Norgrove's case, to actually praise the US Special Forces for going in and throwing a grenade which killed her, I just find astounding. At the very least he could have done was just to make no comment about it, but he's actually patting them on the back, which I just think is revolting.
Beggar's belief, isn't it? That, I mean, it makes you wonder, I mean, you know, what's coming next, to be honest with you, Tony.
Afghanistan, you mentioned Afghanistan, Tony, and I know that you've read the report that's been published by War on Wants on Afghanistan.
That's right. This is just yesterday. War on Want brought out a fantastic report into Afghanistan.
74% of British people against the war.
Sorry?
74% of people are against the British war. They want the troops to come home, or at least to come home soon, according to the report, if I'm correct.
And yes, and we are saying, isn't it wonderful that there may soon be democracy in Egypt?
Well, actually, it's interesting.
There is actually democracy in Britain, because our troops are out in Afghanistan.
and the British people don't want them out in Afghanistan. And actually, the British people are being very, very sensible then, because, aren't we? Because we know that if we are waging these foreign occupations and wars abroad, it's much more likely that there will be this whole thing called blowback, which is where if you start going invading or occupying foreign countries, that there's every chance that there will be repercussions at home.
Well, it's actually,
and I think, you know, I think the only thing that that tells us, that War on Want survey, is that the British people are not quite as stupid as some of the press and the military and some of the other dark forces at work in Afghanistan thought they were. And slowly but surely, the British people have figured out that this is an absolute nightmare. I mean, they managed to get the rubber stamp from the United Nations for this, supposedly, but actually it is an illegal war of aggression, and the British troops should come right back home now. One of the things in that report, I don't know if you've had a chance to go through it, which fascinated me, was the section showing the massive amount of work that's being done by the private security industry. The report, by the way, is called The Great Game.
That's right, yes.
And, of course, this is the way... They've done a fantastic job, I think, War on Want here. And this is the way, as we were talking about wargaming last week, weren't we?
We were.
This is the way that the authorities here in Britain and in the US, the Western Alliance, supposed Western Alliance that's in Afghanistan, do see it. It's a kind of chess game.
Well, it's actually interesting.
Is the Queen or the Bishop has come right out from the West, from NATO. NATO, of course, being a supposedly, anyway, a defensive treaty where we defend ourselves against an attack by the Russians or whatever. No, that's all changed. And it's now an offensive treaty. So we have now gone out and decided that we want to have our armies in between the Russians and the Chinese.
Well, it's actually interesting you brought up Afghanistan, Tony, and Tariq, with that War on Want report, because there's been another article floating about today on blacklistednews.com that is costing the US just under £300 million.
Every day,
I think it is, the report quoted on the War on Afghanistan itself.
Well, it's also costing the US an incredible and actually unestimatable social price as well. I mean, if you've seen some of the things that are going on, the mass unemployment now that's sweeping the United States, what's happening, of course, is for military reasons, no other reason really I can see, massive amounts of wealth are being sucked out of the United States and ploughed into these ridiculous foreign occupations. Now, if these sort of things were to happen immediately after the Second World War, there would be absolute outrage, saying, well, hang on a minute, this is the kind of thing that led to World War II, and this is the end of the Second World War. We decided was never going to be allowed to happen again. And yet it does seem to be happening. This whole thing, was it Operation Enduring Freedom? This is what they call the operation over there. I think it should be really just called Operation 1984, Endless War. It does seem that that's the kind of tactic that they're using.
Unfortunately, Tony,
and achieving nothing.
We are more or less just about a minute or so away from the end of the show now, so I'd just like to ask you at this point, so you have a weekly programme, that's the Drive Time programme, BCFM, and State of the City Reports, between 5 to 7pm every Friday on BCFM, and you can go to www.thisweek.org to download previous shows and to listen to the show as well, I believe. And what's lined up for this week?
Well, we've got a bit of a special guest this week who's coming and staying in his caravan in Bristol just for the Friday evening. And he is one of the longest-serving activists in the British Green Party. His name's Brian Leslie, and he ran the Green Party Economics Group and still does for many, many years. He's someone that when I met him first about 15 years ago, Brian Leslie was then talking about the coming economic problems to come. And so this is why I've invited him to come and have a chat with us about, first of all, what the policies that he's been talking about for the last few, couple of decades are, and that is how to sensibly, easily and peacefully transition from the current way that we run our money system to something which actually works for the people, so that money serves people rather than people serve the money system. And then we'll be talking with him, I think, also about his ideas for the future here in the UK. Mm. And so that's Brian Leslie, and he'll be on 6 o'clock on Friday.
Well, that's all coming up on BCFM. And that website again, Tony?
It's thisweek.org.uk.
Thisweek.org.uk.
One of the things that came out of the War on Want report, which everyone can look at on the War on Want website, is the PDF file there. 3 million Afghans are refugees or have been displaced internally since this wonderful thing we started back in 2001. It's absolutely appalling. 3 million Afghans displaced or refugees.
Tony Gosling, as ever, thank you very much for joining us again. And guys, take a look at the BCFM website and you'll find Tony Gosling on there along with Martin Summers. Well, this is it then, folks. We have come to an end of another edition of Behind the Headlines. We've got our Facebook page. Many of you, if you want to take a look at it, Cloudcast will be up inshallah in the next couple of days or so. Up until then, next week we will have more guests for you. Tony will be here, Martin will be here, and the sports our sports reporter Humayun, myself, and Tariq Ziad. Until then, till next week, 8 till 10, it's a very good evening to you all, and have a good week. We shall see you same time, same place on Tuesday from between 8 p.m. and 10 p.m. If you've got little ones, give them a hug, give them a kiss. Tell him you love him. A very good evening to you all.